Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we have Paul with us. Welcome back, Paul. It's been a little while.
Hey, thank you. It has been a little while.
And I know you're busy. You're going to be going to the National Constitution Party Convention later this month?
Yes, last week of the month. It's the 24th through the 27th, and we'll be discussing a number of important things. And
anything you want to disclose? You want to create, put a little heat on the Bunsen burner?
Well, there are a couple of proposals to change the bylaws, and they are big ones. One has been proposed by, not the bylaws, the platform.
Okay.
One's been proposed by none other than Cleon Skousen.
Not and Cleon. Not Cleon.
I am sorry.
It starts with
Joel
a J. Joel. That's right, Joel.
Okay. One has been proposed by Joel Skousen. The other has been proposed by myself. I think the one that I did is a little longer than it needs to be, so I've been working on it a little bit.
Okay.
And but the idea, I think, that needs to be, you know, you and I have been discussing this for years, GR. The idea that I think needs to be heavily promoted is that we need to focus, we need to unite as a people on full compliance with the Constitution.
Yep.
And that's the direction that I want to take.
Yeah, but there should be some changes to the bylaws, because one of the things that I think is imperative is the ability of the party to react quickly. And it seems like to make a change, it is an act of, you know, beyond Congress. It's, you know, an act of God to get, you know, leadership together to be able to do something quickly. And so you really need to look at your bylaws to say, you know, how, you know, there's so many things that are going on that you guys need to be able to engage in that currently it just doesn't, your bylaws don't allow you to do anything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's like you have the ability using Robert rules to suspend, you know, the order, the you know, suspend the rules at that kind of point in time to be able to take care of important business. And so you'd think that you'd have that in your bylaws to be able to do something like that so that the Constitution Party can actually respond formally or do something formally. Anyway, I see that most parties do that. They're really hamstrung in not being able to be as dynamic as they need to be, especially if you have a powerful platform like what you're talking about, one that is demanding full compliance to the Constitution. Then you can actually use that platform as, you know, the, I'll just call it a bully pulpit, to be able to get out and call out the parties and do things far more aggressively. But, you know, I have no idea where I've obtained this such aggression in my paradigm or in my brain, the way I think. I don't know where that came from.
I can say you do have aggression in your paradigm, but I think the times, you know, GR, I think the times require it.
Yeah.
So and that's your way of dealing with it, and it needs to involve all of us.
Right.
You know, it was Jefferson who said that government degenerates when left to the rules of the people alone. The people themselves are its only safe depositories, and we've gotten to the place where the people need to stand up. And my hope is to communicate that message in such a way that we have to stop this hero worship thing.
Yeah. Okay? Yep. That's right.
Okay. We need, the people need to be involved, and that's so far from our paradigm we really have an uphill battle, GR.
Yes, until Christ descends from his throne, mm-hmm. I will just put off worshiping any other person.
Right.
And so, right. And to be clear, it's the throne that has been, you know, given to him by the Father. So anyway, right. So yesterday, let's dive into this topic because
sure.
We got a lot of reading to do. And so yesterday I provided this view because see, in Wyoming and in many other states, they're moving down the path of nullification. And okay. the biggest problem, and in Wyoming specifically, they had a bill. It was a bill that originated in the Senate that was challenging the federal lands. But it wasn't challenging it on the Constitution. It was challenging, you know, its changes and what they find acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And as I look at it, on the base, they are not hitting the constitutional issue. And as a matter of fact, they don't address this unconstitutional paradigm that the federal government projects. And so yesterday I read a part of this document. It's called The Federal Land Ownership, Constitutional Authority, and History of Acquisition, Disposal, and Retention. And so as I looked at this document, I went to page 5. This is a 2007 report that came out from the federal government. And here they are telling the world how they believe they have this authority in the Constitution. And so let me read this to you because you probably didn't hear yesterday's show because
okay.
this is where I think we need to really get into, and I'll talk a little bit more on the property side because you hear me say all the time that the Constitution enumerates and delegates very specific roles, responsibilities, powers, and property.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've kind of come right out and helped people understand the details of the property. And this is what they claim. Constitutional basis of federal land ownership, they call this the property clause.
Okay.
The United States addresses the relationship of the federal government to lands. Hold it. Did you ever see the word lands in the Constitution?
No.
Did you ever see the delegation of a relationship to ambiguous lands?
No.
Okay. And so...
No. Article 1, Section 8 has specifics about what land the federal government can touch, correct?
Correct.
Okay. But it's... Lands is... I don't even think it's a word.
Well, yeah. So there is a use of lands, but that you'll find in Article 2, or actually, no, Article 3, and you'll find it in... what is this article?
In the judicial clause?
Oh, no. So if you look at Section 2 of Article 3, it basically says the lands. Okay, so this is the judicial power, and this
right,
is it says
power.
This, between citizens of different states, between citizens of the same state claiming lands under grants of different states. In other words,
okay.
They say that they have this power basically injected in. And remember, we talked about how the 11th Amendment kind of modified part of that. But bottom line, you know, the mention of lands is not the mention of possessing lands. It is the mention of basically stepping in with a dispute over the claims of lands between a private party and somebody in another state or another state. Right? So
right.
That's it. I mean,
okay.
I just want to be clear. The word land and lands is mentioned in the Constitution, but not in the context of delegating just blanket power or authority. And you're right.
Yeah.
Article 1, Section 8 is where you find the... I'll call it the property clause,
mm-hmm.
because in subsection 16, the federal government has the power to, exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square as may, by secession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress, become the seat of government of the United States. So they have exclusive authority over that chunk of land.
Right.
In regulating that for the purposes of policing and keeping order. That this way, the federal government has autonomy from the states, where the states can't, you know, basically regulate the land and harass the federal government because states are sovereign. And so it, then it also states in the same clause, and to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature. In other words, they have to, for them to have exclusive legislation, they have to, one, purchase the land from the state legislature, and it has to be for these very specific purposes. And it's basically, I'll read that again.
I've got erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, stockyards, and other needful buildings.
There you go. And so those are the only justifications for the federal government to purchase a land. If it's not enumerated, like let's say they really do want to purchase this swamp land for, you know, saving some creatures. It has to be enumerated in the Constitution for them to be able to purchase, you know, endangered lands of endangered species. And then they still has to get the state's buy-in for them to possess that land.
So can I
go ahead?
Can I add something?
Yeah.
One of the, if you've ever read some of the Western states' constitutions, and when I was in Idaho, I did read the state constitution, and there had a couple of things in it that were, one, egregious violations because it violated the clause that all states are equal.
Equal footing clause, yes.
Yeah, the equal footing. Okay, and in the federal constitution, there are two things. In the Idaho constitution, as I remember, there were two things that bothered me. One was that the state would never contest federal lands owned within the borders of the state. And two, that state was an inseparable part of the union.
That's right.
Okay,
right.
So those two items, I read those, you know, in the Constitution. I said, this isn't right.
Right.
Not sure how to take care of it at the time. I mean, we were in Idaho,
right?
You know, several years ago.
Right.
But it stood out at its face. You know, even then, even before I met you, you know, I knew enough about the Constitution, GR, to know that someone had overstepped their bounds in the creation of the Western states.
Right. It's, you know, I can almost hear the little child say, "Ooh, grandpa said a bad word," you know, or some uh-oh type of thing. Right. As you read the constitutions of several of the Western states, most of them and most all of these started forming after 1850 because the federal government at this point started taking land and saying you have to reserve parts of your land for federal purposes. Now, did you see anything there that gave them the ability to hold any land of a state any purpose other than those specific?
Sure, I think it's strictly prohibited, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. So, but it's not enumerated. So in other words, regardless of when you look at the state and the land that they were putting aside, it wasn't because they were going to create this fort so the federal government didn't have to buy the land. No. You have to buy the land because that's exactly what it says. All places purchased by the consent of the legislator of the state. Legislature, right? So I'm getting excited. And so, because this is just so huge, this is such a big problem, because the federal government really believes. And so, let's move on to this. That now they say the property clause, right? Because they're saying the property clause. Well, that right there, what we read is the property clause. Then they say the property clause, Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2. And so this, I went through this yesterday, and and I'm going to break it down. If you go to Article 4, Section 3, and you read the very first paragraph, there are three clauses in the very first paragraph. The first clause is, new states may be admitted by the Congress into this union, which causes this whole section to be the admission of states into the union.
Right. Right.
That's what this part, if you had a title, that's exactly what this would have done. And the next clause, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of another state. And then the third clause to this paragraph, nor any state be formed by the jurisdiction of two or more states or parts of states without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned as well as of the Congress. So now you have these three hard stipulations of states being admitted into the union. Ancillary as a necessity for the federal government to admit states into the union, they are being given limited powers in this next clause or this next paragraph. And it says the Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or property belonging to the United States.
Yeah, other property belonging to the United States.
So territories belong to the United States only as a stewardship. This is not a power. They have the power to dispose of and make needful rules. The territories themselves is a responsibility that they are to actually prepare to it for that territory to become a state. Which is exactly why, and this is why we're reading the notes on the convention. There's no concept at all that the federal government could become the richest land baron and the richest land, you know, holder of the world. And somehow they've basically come right out and said all lands are federal lands. They're just allowing the states to have what they have.
Wow.
Do you really believe that the framers created such a government as, and we're going to be going through the notes on this, but as we, you know, as I break this down, when we look at the context, the federal government couldn't even strip slaves from slave owners. As a matter of fact, they felt that it was such a hands-off regarding property that they felt that they it needed to be a state's issue, and that's how they decided to, you know, compromise this, you know, this problem that obviously wasn't going to go away because three states were willing to just break up the union. There were the southern states at that, and you've heard me, we've talked about this before, but bottom line, they did not even take that step to even take personal property away from people. They could have and should have. But what would have been the consequence had they actually done that? Would have that, because actually going into the Constitution, declaring all people to be free, wouldn't necessarily be this power, you know, of, you know, controlling all property. It would be establishing the individual property rights of every human. Right. And so when it goes down here, they actually make this last paragraph or this next paragraph that I think is worth stating. This provision provides broad authority for Congress. This is the congressional report where they're actually justifying, or they're telling themselves that this provides broad authority for Congress to govern the lands acquired by the federal government as it sees fit, and to exercise exclusive authority to decide on whether or not to dispose of those lands. Are you kidding me? So when we look in here, there is nowhere where once a state is formed that the federal government has the ability to retain land.
Well, they don't stop there. Then they...
Yeah.
Just, and then they... They add the Supreme Court into this collusion.
Yes.
okay?
Yeah. And this, again, is where the Supreme Court is making law where they have no authority to do so. And anything that creates a constitutional precedence requires the states to buy into it. And see, the states have become so passive because for the past century and a half, they have been told that the federal government, between these three departments, can do literally anything they want to, because as long as they agree, that's what matters.
Mm-hmm.
They have perverted the relationship of the parents and the child, the federal government being the child and the states being the parents. And this is why things are so perverse. It's almost like if you've ever had seen a nightmare where a child has a, and I've seen movies on this, where a child has the power to actually control the parent with thought or what have you. Now, I've seen a couple of Twilight Zones and other episodes where, you know, that actually exists and how evil that child becomes.
Twilight Zone takes you back a few decades, GR.
Oh, well, I watch it on Netflix. I'm a gun-snapping teenager. Anyway... Anyway, without aging myself further, let's dive into, because we got about 3 minutes before the break, let's dive into this dialogue regarding property.
Okay. And
go ahead. So it starts off with Mr. Butler.
Mr. Butler.
Just so you know, I believe, I didn't do it. So what I will do is when somebody is speaking, I will try to interrupt you to say, this person is an anti-federalist.
Okay.
Because what they say might have a little bit of a twist to, you know, to the paradigm.
So who is Mr. Butler?
So Mr. Butler is from, Pierce Butler is from South Carolina, and he's a federalist.
Okay.
And so Governor Morris, a federalist. Mr. Bedford from Delaware, and he is, I'm pretty sure he's a federalist. Yep, he's a, he is. But Mr. Ellsworth is an anti-federalist. And let me see here, North Carolina, Mr. Williamson, he's good. Patterson, New Jersey, Patterson is good. And we have...
Mr. Gary, is it Massachusetts?
Gary is an anti-federalist.
Okay.
And so Mason is an anti-federalist as well. And then we go into the next level of property. So we have a couple of anti-federalists going through this. So go ahead.
All right. So here we go.
For 1 minute, yes.
Of South Carolina, and he's speaking of property.
Uh-huh.
Said he could not let down his idea of the people of America so far as to believe they would, from mere respect to the convention, adopt a plan evidently unjust. He did not consider the privilege concerning money bills as of any consequence. He urged that the second branch ought to represent the states according to their property. All right.
Okay, so we'll stop right there. So yesterday I actually covered this concept of creating the Senate into a body of the aristocracy. In other words, they hadn't come to the point of where the state legislature would appoint the Senate to basically take care of, you know, their interest while the House took care of the people's interest. So they haven't baked this far enough to where they've come up with that. Those two separate sovereigns, the people and the government that the people form to obtain representation. And so our suffrage in the House and suffrage in the Senate, because that's what happens in a governing body of people. When you have a Republican form of government and you have one body of representatives and another body, each body is providing suffrage for somebody. Whether it be for the people, whether it be for the states, or the aristocracy in the House of Lords in Parliament. Sure. That's who they were protecting. And so anyway, so we're going to go into a break. So when we come back, this next long paragraph will be Mr. Morris, Governor Morris, and from Pennsylvania. And he will actually, I think, kick open or kind of rip open the can of worms where they really start talking in more detail regarding this concept of property and, you know, representing the states according to their property. Okay, we'll be right back because slaves are property. We'll be right back. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so I know it kind of piques your interest when I just said the last part before we went mm-hmm. into break, that yeah. slaves are property. Now, I want to, now, you, what I'm going to say should be earth-breaking, groundbreaking, whatever, you know, whatever the catchword is. When we look at the Constitution and forming this Constitution and what Mr. Butler just said, you know, that the second branch ought to represent the states according to their property. Mm-hmm. And included in the property and included in the Constitution, the reason why slaves were included, because, see, the North was saying, hey, that's property. They can't have representation. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, well, no, they're people and they should have some representation, which created this 3/5 rule. Mm-hmm. I know as is repugnant as slavery is and was, you have to thank the Southern states for actually making such a position on property to actually create the paradigm of what ended up becoming of the Senate, where the property, the entire state, is to be represented in the second house, in the Senate. In other words, as they started making these compromises, because the 3/5 rule hadn't even come up yet. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that they actually hit the 3/5 rule and that we're going to actually start covering that. But my point is this, that their responsibility was to preserve property.
Right.
In other words, that's why the Constitution maintained the paradigm of whatever the state thought its property was. Like in that state, mm-hmm. you know, in your state, you want to have slavery. It's up to you,
mm-hmm.
not us. We're hands off when it comes to property, which is antithetical to the paradigm today.
Right.
Interesting.
But because they took that position, we, the Constitution should take a stance on property as a purity. Do you know what I mean? In other words, they went that far to protect property. Why should they stop now?
Well, so what happened was they shifted slavery mm-hmm. from being an issue of property to being an issue of life and liberty.
Right.
And so they finally shunned the light that the Declaration of Independence created. Remember, we haven't gotten to it yet, but the August 22nd, George Mason standing up and saying, because they finally decided that they were going to keep slavery. They kept on wanting to alleviate these things. They didn't want slavery or, you know, this document to maintain this. And so this is why when people read Article 1, Section 9 and the 1808 stopping of the importation of persons, why didn't they include the importation of slaves instead of persons? Because at this point in time, until 1808, from the point of the beginning of the federal government, the states had full control over the migration of people. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until 1808 when that power shifted, which is why the only power delegated to the federal government was to ensure a uniform rule of immigration, or naturalization, I should say.
Correct.
That's it. There was no clause that all of a sudden said that they had any other responsibility other than when you get into Article 4 that they were responsible for keeping invasions from occurring. So I'm just hoping that the epiphany is kind of, you know, pow, you know, starting to hit people now, that when you really look at this Constitution, the sacredness of property in context to the federal government was absolutely respected. Mm-hmm. That the, because when we talked about just previously, the delegation of property that was granted was for very specific things, never nowhere. And as a matter of fact, when we get into the ratification debates, we'll clearly talk about general powers. Mm-hmm. And we'll clearly hear the Federalists come right out and say, there are no general powers granted, where the Anti-Federalists are saying they can do anything to you. And they're saying, no, these powers are enumerated. If it's not listed, they can't do it. So if it's not under their authority, they have no power to be involved in it. And because they turned their backs, I'll just tell you, some Federalists deliberately turned their backs on the ratification debates, John Marshall being one of them. And he became mm-hmm. integral in allowing the subversion of this relationship of the child taking control of the parents. I mean, he was one of the key players in that, mm-hmm. even though this was really the design of Alexander Hamilton. John Marshall was actually the guy that made it happen.
And he knew better.
Absolutely.
Because he didn't argue that way during the ratification debates.
Correct. The way he argued during the ratification debates and what he ended up doing was completely contrary. It was in actual direct conflict with each other. So go ahead and let's dive into Mr. Morris of Pennsylvania.
Okay. Mr. Gouverneur Morris of Pennsylvania thought the form as well as the matter of the report objectionable. It seemed in the first place to render amendments impracticable. In the next place, it seemed to involve a pledge to agree to the second part if the first should be agreed to. He conceived the whole aspect of it to be wrong. He came here as a representative of America. He flattered himself he came here in some degree as a representative of the whole human race, for the whole human race will be affected by the proceedings of this convention. He wished gentlemen.
How profound was that?
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Go ahead. He wished gentlemen to extend their views beyond the present moment of time, beyond the narrow limits of place from which they derive their political origin. If he were to believe some things which he had heard, he should suppose that we were assembled to truck and bargain for our particular states. He cannot descend to think that any gentlemen are really actuated by these views. We must look forward to the effects of what we do. These alone ought to guide us. Much has been said of the sentiments of the people. They were unknown. They could not be known. All that we can infer is that if the plan we recommend be reasonable and right, all who have reasonable minds and sound intentions will embrace it, notwithstanding what had been said by some gentlemen. It's like you say, reasonable people equally informed seldom disagree.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
Okay. Yeah. Let us suppose that the larger states shall agree and that the smaller refuse, and let us trace the consequences. The opponents of the system in the smaller states will no doubt make a party and a noise for a time, but the ties of interest of kindred and of common habits which connect them with the other states will be too strong to be easily broken. In New Jersey particularly, he was sure a great many would follow the sentiments of Pennsylvania and New York. This country must be united. If persuasion does not unite it, the sword will. He begged that this consideration might have its due weight. The scenes of horror attending civil commotion cannot be described, and the conclusion of them will be worse than the term of their continuance. The stronger party will then make traitors of the weaker, and the gallows and halter will finish the work of the sword. How far foreign powers would be ready to take part in the confusions, he would not say. Threats that they will be invited have, it seems, been thrown out. He drew the melancholy picture of foreign intrusions as exhibited in the history of Germany and urged it as a standing lesson to other nations. He trusted that the gentlemen who may have hazarded such expressions did not entertain them till they reached their own lips. But returning to the report, he could not think it in any respect calculated for the public good. As a second branch is now constituted, there will be constant disputes and appeals to the states which will undermine the general government and control and annihilate the first branch. Suppose that the delegates from Massachusetts to Rhode Island in the upper house disagree and that the former are outvoted. What results? They will immediately declare that their state will not abide by the decision and make such representations as will produce that effect. The same may happen as to Virginia and other states. Of what avail, then, will be what is on paper? State attachments and state importance have been the bane of this country. We cannot annihilate, but we may perhaps take out the teeth of the serpents. He wished our ideas to be enlarged to the true interest of man, instead of being circumscribed within the narrow compass of a particular spot. And after all, how little can the motive yielded by selfishness for such a policy? Who can say whether he himself, much less whether his children, will the next year be an inhabitant of this or that state? All right, GR, translation required. Okay, I just read this thing.
Yeah.
I don't think I could explain it to anybody.
Well, so actually, he is creating, because in the previous part that I read yesterday, I kind of talked about this concept of, well, the concept of having two parties opposing each other and giving them, you know, those self-interests that actually keeps this check and balance. And so there was this, you know, in the previous conversation of property and or actually the establishment between the two branches of Congress, from the House to the Senate, you know, giving them opposing interests so that they have these guards. Now, as they were breaking this down, this was still basically based upon this concept of rich, because one of the things I pointed out yesterday was
rich,
okay. The affluent, okay. The aristocracy. Mm-hmm. They were the ones that were really the ones controlling the state, especially more so down in the southern states, because those were the big plantation owners, the large families that had heavily vested interest in that state. And as they started, and we talked about this before, they were like franchises. They were actually spreading across the South as they were going into Alabama, Mississippi, and so forth. And when we see a few years later, by 1820, there were families that were already becoming concerned that Missouri was not going to be a slave state, which got mm-hmm. all of the other families, the franchise across the southern states, politically active to make Missouri and to inflict slavery upon all of the southern states to ensure the preservation of slavery, because they saw it becoming dwindling. It was mm-hmm. really dwindling. And so the Missouri Compromise was this, I'll just say this, really nefarious design by these plantation owners using their money to affluence those who were in the political fray in the North.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that, they were able to do that. Now, keep in mind that what was really on the table was they were looking at the second branch. So the original proposal was the second branch would be selected by the House, right, by the House of Representatives, by the first branch. That was the Virginia plan. And so breaking it down to the Connecticut Compromise, they started talking about representing the states. Well, they hadn't gotten and they hadn't galvanized this concept that the state legislature would appoint those people for 6 years. They were really looking at still maintaining some representation of people, which is why yesterday it was about the aristocracy. Now, as he looks at, and this is, he's basically identifying the problem with that. And the three little parts or four parts that kind of really come out with Madison when he stated, because this to me is really important. Madison literally makes this judgment saying he flattered himself. He came here in some degree as a representative of the whole human race, which will be affected by the proceedings of this convention. He was absolutely correct. Governor Morris was absolutely correct that the whole human race was going to be affected by this one document. And then, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I noticed that there were some judgment statements made. He flattered himself.
Yes.
Okay.
So, you know, and I don't, you know, I think that has a lot to do with Madison's humility. Because right. Madison didn't think that. He was just trying to do what was right. In other words, Madison was a man of intellectual character that wanted to do what was best, not necessarily what was like in the grander scale of what was more righteous. Now, I don't know Governor Morris. He may have been a preacher or something, but having that tone. The next part he basically quotes is he says, "We must look forward to the effects of what we do. These alone ought to guide us." In other words, everything we do, we got to look forward of, you know, how this is going to affect. And so down a little bit further, he says, "This country must be united. If persuasion does not unite us, the sword will." And then he talks about the horrors of this civil commotion. And he basically comes out and says, the stronger party will then, because as we break down the republic and we look at the smaller states versus the larger states, he's seeing that the larger states, the same way that they're doing this, the larger states will prevail. Especially by the way they were concocting it. And so the stronger party will then make traitors of the weaker, and the gallows and halter will finish the work of the sword. How far foreign powers would be ready to take part in the confusions, he would not say. Okay. In other words, he basically laid it out there that there's no doubt that Britain and some of the other, you know, European nations would get involved with intrigue. In other words, you know, with scrupulous, you know, money corruption or what have you. And then he basically says he drew the melancholy picture of foreign intrusions as exhibited in the history of Germany and urged it as a standing lesson to other nations. Okay, so he's kind of, you know, I think looking in the full theory of what are we really doing here if we allow this process to move forward, because the first branch, those men already, because I think it was already said in yesterday's show that those who seek representation will actually naturally become disaffected. In other words, they will no longer see themselves as citizens of the state, even though they're representing the people of that state.
Huh? Wait a minute.
Because in those days, having two domiciles was just ludicrous.
Okay.
What would end up happening was people would actually move to D.C. and they would just go back to run their campaigns.
Mm-hmm. Which is what they're doing.
Absolutely, yeah. Because they've moved away from the agrarian society, even though in the framers' days, he was looking in the future of saying that this could easily become, you know, this self-licking ice cream cone where they keep on granting themselves all of these abilities. Then he kind of, this final comment that's worth pointing out is he says the state attachments and state importance have been the bane of this country. You've heard me say this all the time, that the states have always been the bad actors. We cannot annihilate them, but we may perhaps take out the teeth of the serpents. He wished our ideas to be enlarged to the true interest of man instead of being circumscribed with the narrow compass of a particular spot. In other words, let's look at the macro instead of, you know, looking at the micro. This is what we need to do here and here. And so this was really more of he's just, you know, throwing out his contempt for how things were moving forward in this concept of the first house and the second house. That was kind of, when we looked at what Mr. Butler said, was really talking about the first house and the second house, and that the second house would be representative of the property of the state.
Right.
And so, but they still hadn't really said, hey, we can't allow the politicians, because I think one of the things that was stated yesterday was also this concept of, you know, creating this natural progression that you did your time in the state, then you went your way up to the federal government, then you locked yourself in as a senator. And it became this professional career type of thing in, you know, this the earlier comments. Now, I didn't give the analysis of that because I ran out of time yesterday. I mean, I literally just finished the words and we went at, you know, the end of the show because I kind of ranted a little bit too much regarding property and so forth. But
I don't think they wanted that.
I don't think
they wanted that concept where you make your career, you work up and stay there.
Correct.
Right?
Right. So Mr. Bedford of Delaware, who is a Federalist, and you know, these men ultimately became huge endorsers of the federal constitution. I mean, when I say South Carolina and Delaware had no anti-federalists, even though there were anti-federalists that were actually involved, every single one of these men signed the Constitution on September 17th and went back to their states endorsing this Constitution. When I say when we're talking about identifying the anti-federalists, we're talking about identifying those people who ended up leaving this convention without signing.
Wow. Okay.
And then when we look at what they were doing and what they were saying in the Constitutional Convention, like Gary and Livingston and so forth, we'll actually see how, you know, they still were men of honor. They weren't going to outright lie, but they basically put negative spins. And as I looked at George Mason, Livingston, and some of these men, as they put these negative spins, the negative spin always assumed that the Constitution was being, you know, the Constitution was the problem, when actually everything that they laid out, George Mason, like when he talked about how the militia was going to be disbanded, really meant that the federal government would have had to actually deliberately fulfill their responsibility in arming, equipping, and training and being active in the state militia on a regular basis to ensure that the militia was maintained. In other words, he said that we'll lose our militia because of them. No, not because of the Constitution. The Constitution requires that they do these things.
Right.
And so his comments regarding the Constitution being problematic and needing an amendment, he was wrong. He was actually obviating and putting an improper paradigm to those clauses. And that was actually vetted through Nicholas and Madison and the rest of them in Virginia, where they said, no. They have to do these things. That's what the Constitution says. Anyway.
So what's actually happened is that we have lost the militia because we haven't done what we're supposed to do.
We don't have a militia today because the federal government has literally violated the Constitution. The Dick Acts of 1903 are unconstitutional. What they did would require an amendment to the Constitution.
Right.
And the way they forged this permanent body under the federal under federal control of the Air National Guard and the National Guard is absolutely unconstitutional. Because the Navy Reserves is a permanent body. They are to maintain the Navy. So the Navy and the Marine Corps are permanent bodies that must be maintained under their tutelage. But right. when it comes down to the state militia, the fact that they even created the Air Force was a violation, excuse me, was a violation of the Constitution. So anyway, because that's actually any airborne activity outside of the United States belonged to the Navy. The Navy was the exterior guardian of right. America. So anyway, we've got about two and a half minutes, and we've got a long one to do here.
Mr. Bedford. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Mr. Bedford of Delaware. He found that what he had said as to the small states being taken by the hand had been misunderstood, and he rose to explain. He did not mean that the small states would court the aid and interposition of foreign powers. He meant that they would not consider the federal compact as dissolved until it should be so by the acts of the large states. In this case, the consequence of the breach of faith on their part and the readiness of the small states to fulfill their engagements would be that foreign nations having demands on this country would find it their interest to take the small states by the hand in order to do themselves justice. This was what he meant. But no man can foresee to what extremities the small states may be driven by oppression. He observed also in apology that some allowance ought to be made for the habits of his profession in which warmth was natural and sometimes necessary. But is there not an apology in what was said by Mr. Gouverneur Morris that the sword is to unite, by Mr. Gorham that Delaware must be annexed to Pennsylvania and New Jersey divided between Pennsylvania and New York?
Okay, so let me interrupt you there. We'll take a break for tomorrow. We'll start off with to hear such language. To be clear, one of the points he just made was he said he didn't mean that the smaller states that they would be guided by the external. He was literally saying that the smaller states, and he was absolutely correct, that the smaller states, you know, may jump into this, but we're not going to move forward until the large states actually buy into this as well. That's exactly what he said right in the middle of what you just said. He said, in this case, the consequences of the breach of faith on their part and the readiness of the small states to fulfill their engagements would be that the foreign nations have demands on this country, would find it in their interest to take the small states by the hand in order to do them justice. But he was actually talking about the larger states having to do that, that the larger states would have to actually step up and actually preserve the smaller states, is what I believe he was really stating, and helping everybody look at because if the large states ignore and actually create the threat to the smaller states, then that does open them up. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, great. With that, folks, we've got to go. I'm sorry, Paul. I save your comment for tomorrow, Paul, and we will pick it up from there with Mr. Bedford in Delaware. So, folks, going through this, obviously, there's lots of maybe some extra dialogue because we're really only picking up parts and bits. And so, I'm G.R. Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.